By Craner Center for the Performing Arts, celebrating the holiday season with the Champaign-Urbana Ballet's performances of The Nutcracker and A Scottish Christmas, featuring fiddler Bonnie Rideout and friends. For more information, contact the Craner Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit cranertcenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. Eastern Rug Gallery offers a collection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of all sizes, made of pure wool or silk pile, designed to add beauty to any decor, whether homes or offices.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the show Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She also teaches here at the U of I Med School in Urbana-Champaign and once a month stops here on the program. It's always on a Monday, and we talk about women's health. And she usually comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new or in the news, and also to answer questions. And as you know, if you've heard the program before, we try to open it up so that anything that falls within her area of practice, and we've talked about a lot of different things, I know she will do her best to help you out and perhaps add to your health knowledge. We do try to caution people that, of course, we cannot diagnose over the telephone. There are some limits to what we can do. I hope that people will understand that. But I know that the doctor will do her best to help you out with your questions if you would like to give us a call. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line. If it would be a long-distance call for you, that's 800-222-9455. Well, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Glad to have you here. What would you like to talk about?
I thought we could talk a little bit about contraception. There were several news items about contraception in the news in the past week or so, and I thought maybe some of the listeners had seen those news items. The most important release was from the Pfizer company about their long-acting injectable contraceptive Depo-Provera. And there was a release of a long-term study of bone health when you use Depo-Provera. And so that was really the most important contraceptive news. There's also a new contraceptive spray that's gone into testing. So, now,
and where do you spray it?
I don't know. They're in the phase one trials, but most of the creams are on the skin. So, and I suspect it'll be like the estrogen cream that I think we actually talked about last month for menopausal symptoms. Mm-hmm. You actually have to let it dry before you put your clothes on,
or your
treatment goes right into your shirt. But that's exciting. Always new delivery systems get more people effectively using the contraception that they want. So those are really the two biggest stories in terms of contraception. With the Depo-Provera contraception, it is a progesterone-only contraception. It is extremely effective in terms of prevention of pregnancy because it is given as an injection four times a year. And it's fairly potent, and actually the medication is designed to be re-injected every 12 to 14 weeks, every 12 weeks, but you've got a two-week window, so every 12 to 14 weeks. And if you keep on schedule, failure rates are extremely uncommon. And interestingly, the new bone density study results would indicate that it's even better than we think. In that particular study, although there were some questions about slight reductions in bone density over long-term use, we found no pregnancies. So we have to keep in mind that it is a very effective contraception. And the recent studies are going to be two studies that are now included in the package insert information. The study publications haven't been released or put into press yet, but we're working on them. I was on the 7-year adult study, and there is a adolescent study also. And it would indicate that, as we thought, one of the mechanisms that method works in terms of contraception is not only to suppress ovulation, but suppress ovarian function enough that the estrogen levels do go down a little bit. And we know that is one reason why many women on the Depo-Provera won't have menstrual periods, because their lining tissue thins out, and that's a direct estrogen effect. And because of that estrogen level going down, the bone density of users longer than 2 years will actually go down as well. Now, we think that there's nothing wrong with that bone. It's just a little less saturated with calcium, so the thickness goes down. None of the patients got into danger zones. No patients got fractures. No patients were diagnosed with actual osteoporosis in this age group. Although we can talk about how you make that diagnosis of osteoporosis in this age group, it's a little bit more difficult. But the patients that were studied after they discontinued the method, their bone density crept back up, but if patients were on the medicine long enough, it didn't quite return to baseline. So there's a couple of things. Number one, if you are going to use this method longer than 2 years, you do need to discuss with your physician, is this still the best method for you, or are there other options? Number two, you should be doing things that are good for your bones while you're on the medicine. And we know that not smoking is very important. I have a couple things in the news to talk about smoking if we get a chance to do that. Also, you should be getting adequate amounts of calcium and vitamin D in your diet and adequate amounts of exercise. There is no current recommendation that young people should run out and get bone density testing just because they've used this medication. But if somebody has other significant risk factors, that may be an indicated test in young people, although the interpretation is more in question. Think for a teenager who is normally increasing her bone thickness at this point in time, normally physiologically, to slightly have that increase suppressed. One of our questions is there going to be a problem in later life with increased risk for osteoporosis? And the only answer we have for that is to look at breastfeeding moms, because breastfeeding moms have slightly low estrogen. And of course, they're putting some of their calcium into breast milk as well. And we know that while you breastfeed and those estrogen levels go down, your bone density, if you study this group of moms, goes down about the same order of magnitude as what we're looking at with Depo-Provera. And there's currently no studies that ever show a long-term risk of osteoporosis just because you breastfed. So there is a new warning. You can find it on the web or on health news sites, or your physician will, all patients have to come in every 12 weeks for their injection. So at their next injection time, all patients will be given the new information and help to design the right contraceptive for them.
Hmm. Well, just I want to make sure that I understand now. For if a woman chose this as her method of contraception, how long could you expect to use it? I mean, how
before or now?
I mean, now. Well, no more than 2 years?
No, we will still have patients using it for a lot longer than 2 years. But of those patients, they need to look at who they are and what is your current bone health, and do you have any alternatives? And if you're going to continue to use the Depo-Provera, maybe step up your calcium, vitamin D. It'll take more counseling for individuals. At the same time, I think I did talk about results of another study that were released that of a slightly lower dose Depo-Provera. And I actually see it's such an effective contraception. It's going to be extremely effective in lower doses, and that will have less estrogen suppression. Mm-hmm. And I do see in the future more individuals moving to the lower dose. We don't know if that's going to really happen or not. That's a guess based on what we know about the safety of the medication and the results that have been released so far. But there may be patients who have been on it a long time who want to think about alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, other than I guess I'm wondering what would be the advantage of choosing that over anything else other than, say, convenience. So you don't have to remember to take your pill every day. You don't have to put your diaphragm in before you have intercourse. It's pretty much it's ready to go whenever.
The most important aspect of that convenience is it translates into effectiveness. There are actually studies amongst teenagers and young adults where contraceptive use translated into a 25 to 30% failure rate. And we have to realize that failure means a pregnancy. So the failures are very, very significant for this population, whereas it's great if you can come up with other alternatives that are also very convenient that will be as effective. And we know that with the contraceptive patches, you only have to change the patches once a week. We know with the vaginal rings, you can wear those for 3 weeks. And again, the less times you have to remember something. And health educators use the example of brushing your teeth, and they give lectures to audiences. They say, okay, how many of us brush our teeth? And then they say, how many of us brush our teeth once a day, twice a day, three times a day, faithfully, every day for the past month? Can you honestly look in the mirror and say it was you? And most of us have to sit down and say, okay, we missed a time or two. And that's just a good example of how an important health behavior is almost really difficult to comply with, even for somebody who generally believes in it, even for a therapy that's quite effective and certainly harmless. So that's where we really still feel that this therapy is so important. And it's effective right away. I think I've talked before about why it's so effective. And one of the methods is changing the mucus of the cervix to make it less penetrable by sperm, so that within the first 24 hours, you get a mucus effect. And so it kicks in its effectiveness right away, and which birth control pills can't quite shut down ovulation that quickly.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Suzanne Troupin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on this program once a month, always on a Monday. We talk about women's health. Your questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number to call if you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. But we also do have that toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call, you use the toll-free number, and that is 800-222-9455. What else is on your topic list?
Well, we have a lot of discussion all the time about various lab tests and what lab tests we need and how to interpret them. And I know a lot of patients call in and ask when they should have certain tests. And I saw an interesting item in the news regarding personal ordering lab tests. And there is a company out of, there was a press release out of Muncie, Indiana. So kind of in our neighborhood. I'm not sure if we reach over there. But they allow in this system called personal access testing, meaning that they allow patients to come in and order their own blood tests, whereas in many laboratories, you need to have a healthcare provider. It might be your physician assistant or your midwife or your physician. But you need a healthcare provider to actually order your tests. Now, I want to caution anybody who's listening that there are appropriate times to order lab tests, and there are inappropriate times to order lab tests, and making sure your own healthcare provider gets a copy of those lab results and helps integrate the results of those tests into your general healthcare is probably as important as anything else. But apparently patients have really liked this idea, and they are using these services in part to avoid waiting times for certain tests, in part to avoid a costly office visit just to get a laboratory test, and in part to get testing that for whatever reason they don't get ordered anymore. For instance, when I first went into practice in the early 80s, we ordered a lot of routine lab work every year on patients, and we had decided that much of that was not cost effective. So we don't do so much of that anymore. But it is very interesting to me when I do medical research studies involving extremely healthy patients and we do routine lab work because it's part of the study. Occasionally we will find very dramatic, important results. So routine lab work isn't always a waste of time. But I would still encourage patients to at least talk to their healthcare provider before they go and get that test.
Well, I guess my question would be, when the results come back, what do you get? Do you just get a piece of paper with results?
And I think
then
you do.
Then I would think, what you all, what you need is someone to sit down with and discuss with them what the results mean.
Now what
mean.
Do you do?
Yes, what do I do?
For instance, if you were you had a low potassium, now you're taking a potassium supplement, now it's a normal level. Is this, do you continue that supplement in the same dosage, a changed dosage? When exactly do you get that level rechecked, if ever? So these are the kinds of questions you want answered. I would assume, like with other laboratories, if you ask your physician for your physician to receive a copy of that lab work, your physician probably would. But then getting that chain of information established it may take a change in the way some physician offices practice medicine.
Well, we have someone here with a question. Why don't we go to them? Caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Troupin. I haven't been able to listen to your program for several months now, but I wondered if you've been talking about Actonel. My doctor was wanting me to take it, and I wondered what you could tell me about it and whether you, how long it's been around and what experience you've had with it, or also just how you go around choosing something to help an older woman's bones.
Okay, you're asking terrific questions. As you know, that the goal of helping an older woman's bones is to prevent fractures. And these fractures can occur in virtually any bone, but it's more likely to get fractures in the trabecular bone, which is in your spine, in your wrists, and in your hips. And there are two or three different strategies we use. One is we use screening to identify patients who already have established bone loss, either slight or more significant. Secondly, we encourage just basic bone health, which I was talking about just a little while ago. Thirdly, there are two different aspects of using a medicine like Actonel. One would be strictly preventative. So in a healthy individual or individual with osteopenia, low bone but not yet osteoporosis, giving that medicine, what we call prophylactically, to prevent becoming osteoporotic. Or it's used what we call therapeutically in patients with established osteoporosis or established fractures to prevent further bone loss and therefore further fractures. Actonel itself is a well-studied medication that's been on the market quite a while now. They have actually published 7-year safety data, and the current thinking is that with this type of medicine, which is a bisphosphonate, and there are two on the market that we talk about, and one is alendronate and one is the risendronate, the Actonel, with these kinds of medications that you do get continued benefit for each year that you are on it. But we've also shown that if you went off your medicines for one full year, that you do not lose all the good bone density that you have gained. We also have shown that these medicines work to prevent fractures, even in patients whose bone density either doesn't improve or actually slightly reduces, because we know there's more to bone health and strength than just that number alone. There are many new alternatives to Actonel that are being looked into. There was actually a recent article, I believe in the last couple of weeks. I read so many health reports, sometimes I have trouble remembering exactly when I read them. But in the Wall Street Journal, there was a very interesting article about a couple of the new alternatives that are coming out. And one is a bisphosphonate that is called dabantrinate that's currently used for other things that can actually be taken in a once a month dose. And actually, that's a medicine that we're currently enrolling a trial right now, seeing how patients like it. That medication can also be given in an intravenous injection every 3 months. So there we go with the convenience again. And there's another new medicine that's under testing that's also bisphosphonate, a cousin of Actonel, that can be given intravenously once a year. And we're going to be participating in some of the research on that medicine. And some of these trials are really looking at new ways of using the medicine or new delivery systems or looking at specific aspects, we still want to study about them. So I'm pretty excited about those. There are other alternatives. We know that estrogen does help your bone, and in a menopausal patient who has other reasons to use estrogen, she might want to consider that. And then there are the medications that have been nicknamed designer estrogens, but medically they're called SERM, selective estrogen receptor modulators. So they're not steroids, but they do act on the estrogen receptor to improve bone density. And the one medicine that's approved for prevention and treatment of osteoporosis that is a SERM is called Avista. So hopefully that gives you background, kind of a complicated topic.
Yes, thank you very much. And I have already tried Mycalfen and Fosamax some years ago, and I had unpleasant side effects from both of them. So then they put me onto low-dose progesterone and estradiol, not the Prempro ones. But I'm wondering whether is either one of those a bisphosphonate?
No. Progesterone and estrogen are...
No, I didn't mean that. I meant
the... Oh, the Fosamax. Correct.
Mycalfen and the Fosamax.
Yes. The Fosamax is a bisphosphonate. And the number one side effect seems to be what we call GI, gastric related. It can cause some heartburn. It can cause some esophageal irritation, which is why you have to take it in the prescribed way. And that's why the bisphosphonates being administered intravenously are gaining a lot of interest, because some patients cannot tolerate the side effects. And that's why in our particular study, we're specifically looking for people who've had side effects from the bisphosphonates to see if this delivery system would be able to help them.
I see. Well, thank you very much indeed.
Very good. Thank you. We're at the midpoint here. Certainly time for other questions. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on the faculty here of the U of I Med School in Urbana-Champaign once a month, always on Monday. She is here. We talk about women's health. She comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new, but if you have questions on anything that she has discussed, or in fact anything else that has to do with women's health, I know she'll do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. We do also have the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Well, we're waiting to see if we get some more calls. What other things are
Well, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology also came out endorsing the National Institute of Health and Child Development, Child Health and Human Development Study on Child Health. There, the government is launching a study of 100,000 children and specifically looking at what the effects of prematurity and other low birth weight and other kinds of birth defects might be. They will be studying the disease SIDS, the sudden infant death syndrome. They will be studying mental retardation, and it will segment into the kinds of things we try to do in prenatal care to be able to hand off to the pediatrician the healthiest child we can possibly. And I think it's a fairly exciting study, and probably moms around the nation, including some in our listening area, will be asked if their children would like to participate. I don't personally know if we're going to have a branch of that study here in Champaign-Urbana, but it's very exciting, and I look forward to someday hearing the results, although those studies are very long-term. But hopefully I'll still be practicing and wanting to know what's going on.
All right. Well, we have some other callers ready to go now, so let's do that. We'll talk next with someone in Urbana, and that's line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Would you be willing to talk a little bit about pelvic floor surgery? How successful is it usually? What's involved? How long can you expect the effects to last?
Okay. Well, again, tricky subject. Our pelvic floor is made up of a large sling, and that sling has many intertwining muscles, and those muscles help support a number of very important pelvic structures, which include the urethra, where urine comes out, includes the bladder itself, includes the vagina itself, Some of the support structures support the position of the uterus within the pelvis, and they support the rectum and the anus. And there are some sidewall structures as well, and integrity of the pelvic floor helps to prevent bowel, small bowel and large bowel, from prolapsing towards the vagina. So when you say a pelvic floor disorder, you're actually naming a variety of disorders. And the current trend for pelvic floor surgery is to, number one, get a correct diagnosis. And there's been a lot of work by various organizations that study this. There's actually now a fellowship, what we call a subspecialty in my field, where surgeons actually only do this kind of work. And they've done a good job of trying to classify these disorders and pinpoint the disorders so that you can get a correct diagnosis of what is wrong and then have a very specific tailored surgery to fix what is wrong. For instance, if there is no prolapsing of the uterus, you do not need the uterine position to be readjusted. You do not need the uterus to be removed, but you work on whatever is wrong. And so that's the first advance that's come along. The second advance is in modifying the surgeries so that they are better. And that would include using some of these new meshes, placing them tension-free in some of the areas so that instead of suturing to already torn ligaments, we allow what we call the fibroblasts to make supporting new tissue to grow the meshes into position, and that seems to be a more physiologic way of correcting what's wrong. Some of these new operations actually have 5-year track records now and seem to be outperforming the old operations. So there is quite a bit new.
Okay, but it is likely that you will have to have more than one surgery?
Well,
or not necessarily.
Well, not necessarily. There are operations that do fail. None of these operations have 100% success rate. Mm-hmm. Of these operations that are successful, some fail over time, meaning 5 years, 10 years, 20
right.
years. Very few of the studies have ever looked at. Sometimes they run studies such as they gather up anybody they can find who had an operation 20 years ago, and they try to study those individuals. But that's a look-back study, uh-huh. and it's really tough to get good figures on how long those operations are going to last. Also, if other intervening things happen, do you gain a lot of weight? Do you start doing a lot of weight-bearing, heavy lifting? Did you begin on some new medication? Did something else happen? So those are the kinds of things that might affect the integrity of the operation. But many women now can successfully, for instance, have operations that specifically cure stress incontinence, where they're in and out, they get back to work very quickly, they have very good success rate in the 1 to 2 to 5 year time frame, and patients seem to be much happier with some of this pelvic floor surgery than they were 10 and 20 years ago.
Okay, and so the recovery period can be anywhere from, just depending on what's being done, I assume.
Sure.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's continue. And our next is here on our line number 2, and the caller's in Charleston. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling in regards to perimenopausal symptoms. Like, how do you know you're in perimenopause? And is it age-related, or is there a specific time? And then do you think if you're not menopausal yet, should you use those progesterone creams, the over-the-counter wild yam constituted ones, whatever they are? Do you understand my question?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Well, by definition, perimenopause is the time leading up to menopause, and menopause is after you have missed your period for one full year. perimenopause typically lasts 2 to 5 years. The average age of menopause is 51, but anything after 45 is normal. If you are having perimenopausal symptoms and you are under the age of 40, very likely something else is going on. If you are having perimenopausal symptoms and you are in your early to mid-40s, most likely it's truly perimenopause. A physician or a healthcare provider can take a history, if necessary, do some laboratory tests and tell you if that's truly what is going on. In terms of the treatment of perimenopause, it does vary. To answer your question specifically about the progesterone wild GM creams, it depends on what you're buying. If it's the medication that's strictly in a wild yam, our bodies cannot take that medicine and do what the laboratory does to make it progesterone. If it's a progesterone derived from wild yams, then that can be a good cream to use for people who are lacking in progesterone. Most often women having the actual perimenopausal symptoms, they're actually symptomatic in terms of hot flashes, sleeplessness, moodiness, because of lack of estrogen. You can't treat lack of estrogen symptoms with progesterone. You can treat lack of progesterone symptoms with estrogen, and lack of progesterone might be some menstrual irregularities. So probably before using that kind of treatment, it's not really harmful. And it's in part not harmful because it's a very well metabolized medicine that when your body doesn't need it, you just pee it out. And actually, through our skin, progesterone, natural progesterone, is not very well absorbed. So that's why it's not very harmful. And the things they package it in seem to be nice skin creams, so people like them. So it's certainly not harmful, but it's unlikely to be a good treatment for the typical perimenopausal symptoms.
Okay, I'm in my late 40s, and I'm not actually experiencing, you know, I'm having regular periods and everything. So would that mean I'm not perimenopausal, or?
If you're not having symptoms and you're currently having regular periods, by definition, you're not yet perimenopausal.
Okay.
If you're having menopausal symptoms in your late 40s, then you very well may be perimenopausal, but without symptoms, you wouldn't need any treatment.
Okay, all right. So, I was reading something that said this was a good thing to use even if you're in your late 40s and they weren't qualifying it, but I wanted to check in.
What can happen first in the perimenopausal transition is that we stop ovulating, and when you ovulate less, you don't produce progesterone out of your ovary. So what happens is you get an estrogen dominant cycle. And for some women, estrogen dominant cycles can produce lining abnormalities of their uterus, which is why some women will start to get heavier periods or irregular periods or bleeding in between their periods. Those conditions are extremely well treated by the correct dose of progesterone. But again, you would want a diagnosis before actually treating it. But somebody having very regular cycles is probably unlikely to need progesterone supplementation without further diagnosis.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for the call. And again, we'll go on here. We have a caller in Crete next on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, doctor. I have three questions. When one takes an x-ray at a doctor's office, does that become the property, the x-ray itself, become the property of the doctor, or is it the property of the patient? In other words, who controls that?
Okay. Did you have two other questions? Were they on the same topic? Or?
No.
Okay. The x-ray, when a physician does the x-ray, the storage of that document is the responsibility of the physician. Most x-ray and that x-ray department. Most x-rays, however, can be copied, and patients can be provided with a copy.
The second question is, if one has a pinched nerve or thinks one has a pinched nerve, how does one prove it? Is an x-ray, MRI, how do you find out?
Oh, being a gynecologist, that's a little far afield from my field, and I think that would be a good question for our family practitioner call-in show, because I don't want to lead you astray.
Okay. How about your views of a chiropractor?
Well, I have very flexible views about chiropractors, and I think that they help many individuals, but I'm not enough versed in their specialty to answer questions for them. But I think that I never tell a patient not to go to a chiropractor's office, but like with other healthcare providers, it's always a good idea that your primary care provider knows what specific symptoms and conditions you're getting treated, so that they take that into consideration when doing your yearly evaluations. And that's where my opinion sort of ends.
All right. The make-up third question would be, we hear more and more about patients waking up during surgery. Is there anything that we can do to try to guarantee that when we go into surgery, we don't wake up until we're back in the emergency room or back in our bed in our private room?
Well, anesthesia has actually made tremendous progress and is much safer than it ever was because of the advent with newer techniques, so forth and so on, and newer medications. And specifically, many, many patients like to be completely awake for some procedures, as long as they are, of course, comfortable and that the surgeon can work in the region that is necessary. And so specifically tailoring the right kind of anesthesia to the patient in the operation is something that anesthesia teams, whether they be anesthetists or anesthesiologists, do work on. On the same token, that for many operations where it is appropriate for the patient to go to sleep, we usually use techniques and medications to assure that they are comfortable, and part of being comfortable is not being awake, because sometimes we use medications which paralyze the lung, and so somebody is breathing for you, and you're of course constrained to the operating room table, so that can be a somewhat uncomfortable experience. I think that when most surgeons perform surgery, number one, they know that patients can be somewhat light, and so we try to still do the kinds of things that we would do if the patient was completely awake, saying reassuring things, playing reassuring music, and that sort of thing. Secondly, we do use the vital signs to help us determine how deep or light the patient is, and we do counsel the patients regarding what kinds of experiences they might have, so that generally when I have patients that have undergone surgery and we do exit surveys regarding their anesthesia experiences, generally most patients are very satisfied with their anesthesia experiences.
Thank you very much.
All right. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. That's our monthly program on women's health. Dr. Suzanne Troopen is our guest. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. Once a month, she's on the program, and we give you the opportunity to call in and ask about her area practice, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Some other things you'd like to talk about?
Well, we do get a lot of calls about what patients name post-tubal ligation syndrome. And patients have occasionally read in magazines or heard that maybe their periods would have problems if they get a tubal ligation as their form of birth control. And actually, I've spent a fair amount of time saying that as far as we know, ovarian function is not disrupted at all by getting a surgical tubal ligation. And in fact, there was a new study where they specifically did a variety of hormone tests. They did ultrasound specifically measuring the size of the ovary, because in menopause, the ovary does specifically shrink. And they also looked at the blood flow with a special kind of ultrasound that measures blood flow. And in fact, in patients before their tubal ligation and 1 year after their tubal ligation, had no specific change in their hormones, in their volume of the ovary or in their blood flow to the ovary after tubal ligation. So I think that this study should go a long way to putting at rest the somewhat myth of the post-tubal ligation syndrome. At the same time, we've been very excited about the success of the Esure method, which is just little coils that can be inserted under local anesthesia in a quick office procedure without any abdominal operating whatsoever. And they've got a new coding mechanism for the Esures, and insurance companies hopefully will be covering this for many, many patients, different kinds of insurance products. And I look forward to Esure becoming the standard, more so even than tubal ligation someday.
Okay. I think, again, we go back to the phones. We have someone, on our toll-free line, line number four. The caller is in Indiana, I believe. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. I started menopause, premenopause, in my late 40s. I'm now 61, and I'm still suffering from hot flashes and disruptive sleep. Gosh, you know, it's almost 20 years I've been going through this. I wondered what the alternatives are for extended... I had to go off of estrogen for other reasons, so... Maybe that's a question for elderly ladies that would like to get rid of the hot flashes and have a good night's sleep.
What do you think, David? I think early 60s is pretty young. What do you think?
I would say so, yeah. From the place we are now. Yeah.
This young lady's question. When we've done studies of hot flashes, there are even women who are in their 80s that have hot flashes reported, but fortunately, statistically, they're barely a blip. So I can't tell you that this will not persist, but the likelihood is still extremely rare. And the farther you get out from your natural age of menopause, the more likely all these symptoms will recede in terms of hot flashes and sleeplessness. Now, other kinds of conditions that are strictly due to lack of estrogen will actually then kick in, and that's osteoporosis and vaginal dryness and some reduced libido and some bladder symptoms. But in terms of hot flashes and alternatives, there are many, and I think that you'd be somebody that would benefit from seeing your healthcare provider. But first is to get an accurate diagnosis and make sure that's in fact what's going on. Medication side effects, lack of exercise, other sleep disorders can be a problem. Being overweight contributes to hot flashes. And I probably already said medication side effects as well. There are some other hormonal disorders like thyroid that can also contribute. So getting an accurate diagnosis is where we always start. And then beyond that, we generally feel that estrogen treatment is the quickest, best fix. And what's been successful for some individuals is to get temporarily back on lower doses and get weaned off much more slowly. And that seems to be successful for individuals that don't have a strong contraindication to hormone therapy. There are about three or four other medications that we do use, and the SSRIs, medications such as Prozac and Zoloft, do work for treating hot flashes and are currently probably the number one choice after hormone therapy.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have a couple of other callers. I believe they're both in Urbana. We'll go to line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. My wife is particularly worried about ovarian cancer, and I didn't tune in early, but I noticed there was something coming out of the Mayo Clinic last week, which said that for people in stage one and stage two, there's crampy abdominal pain and urinary urgency were the most common symptoms. And for people in stage three and four, abdominal pain and increased abdominal girth were the most commonly documented symptoms, and this only came out really recently, so I don't know if you're on top of it or not, but I was wondering if you could comment and maybe elaborate a little bit on it if you do know about it.
Well, generally speaking, ovarian cancer is not one of our more common cancers, but it has been a very worrisome cancer for gynecologists because if you open up many a textbook, it's always said that it was quote-unquote silent, and that's why we diagnose so many cases in stage 3 and 4 and don't always pick them up in stage 1 and 2. And in the past about 3 or 4 years, I didn't see this particular Mayo Clinic release, but in the past 3 or 4 years, there have been actually a number of studies and publications and communications to gynecologists and physicians who take care of women that, in fact, it's maybe not so silent, but in fact, the symptoms are a little bit more subtle. And the bloating, abdominal pain, vague pains, vague urinary symptoms, vague low back pains are actually quite common. And then the challenge is when these low-grade symptoms should translate into something that we can do to help diagnose what's going on, specifically the ovarian cancer in the relatively rare patient that has it. So that we are paying more attention to these subtle symptoms. And if an individual has these subtle symptoms, what she can do is get a pelvic exam. Pap smear is indicated but not always helpful. A pelvic ultrasound. There are some blood tests that are utilized, and there are some blood tests that are under development that are going to be more effective than what we have. But you're absolutely right. If someone has these kinds of symptoms that you were mentioning, crampy abdominal pain or vague abdominal or GI symptoms, she should go and get an evaluation by her healthcare provider.
So it doesn't sound like there's, looks like things are still in development as far as a specific test, but just a general.
Well, we have the one blood test, the CA125, but it underperformed in early testing, meaning that we had to take out an awful lot of healthy ovaries to find just a couple that weren't healthy.
Wow. Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's go to another caller here. This is also someone in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a question about recurrent vaginal yeast infections. And I understand that some of the factors that could contribute would be being diabetic or HIV positive. And if you're not either of those things, but you have recurrent yeast infections, what are some of the most successful treatments for that?
Well, again, it's very important to get the right diagnosis. And there are some people that self-treat very frequently and really don't have yeast, but they have trichomonas or they have bacterial vaginosis. So
right.
If you've self-treated more than a couple of times, it's a good time to get a checkup. The recent study came out talking about fairly long-term therapy, 6 months of therapy or long-term daily therapy for a number of weeks and then going into possibly weekly therapy, and that can help to eradicate recurrent problems. Unfortunately, the yeast can live happily with us for very long periods of time without causing any serious symptomatic systemic symptoms, so that it's a tough one to completely eradicate because many of us just naturally colonize with yeast on our skin or in the vagina. And there's a lot of very interesting work going on right now on overall vaginal health and the yeast organism itself. Here at the University of Illinois over in the Vet Med School, they're doing some very interesting scientific work that will maybe help to solve this problem in a more natural way someday.
So if I know that my diagnosis is actually yeast infections because I've been to a gynecologist, but I've been treated with Nizoral a couple of times and it still keeps coming back, what medication would be the next step after that?
Well, you know, we don't diagnose over the phone, but
right.
there are a number of antifungals, including oral fluconazole, that seem
Diflucan.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That is Diflucan as yeah. its generic name,
right.
And you might be somebody that could discuss with your healthcare provider longer term use of that medication, but There are always side effects. There are drug interactions. There are other considerations. We worry about long-term liver health with long-term antifungal use. So sometimes getting basic blood testing is important. And so that's definitely something you're going to have to discuss with your own physician.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much. We're down to the point here. We have maybe about a minute or so.
I know. And the other thing about yeast infections is the type of contraception that you use. And for instance, women who use condoms are more likely to get urinary tract infections, and women who use oral contraceptives are actually a little bit more likely to get yeast infections as well. And so sometimes other aspects of gynecologic health can influence what kind of contraceptive choice you make. And sometimes altering the contraception plan will, in fact, help prevent some of these infections. There are also a lot of research. We don't really have any of these available now in what we call microbicides. So medications that you would specifically use to prevent acquisition of infections, not just prevent acquisition of pregnancy the way spermicides do.
Well, and because that maybe part of the issue is your body becoming hospitable to the yeast or not.
Correct.
I'm sure that there are some people who think, well, maybe by changing diet, by
Absolutely.
Doing sort of different
and it's
things,
true.
you can influence it.
And that is true. An active culture yeast that the yogurts, excuse me, active culture yogurts that have acidophilus in them, if you incorporate that into your diet, it's actually known to reduce your chances of yeast infections as well.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll have to leave there with the promise that next month, I think, we'll be doing it again. I suppose that'll be almost around the end of the year, so I'm not sure how we're going to, if that's going to affect our schedule.
I think we have a time. I think I saw an email about our schedule,
right.
But I don't remember what it was.
Well, Dr. Trupin will be here,
I'll be here
next month in about a month. She's generally here on the fourth Monday of the month. We talk about women's health. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Ursula Bacon was 10 years old when she and her parents fled Eastern Europe to escape the Nazis. Bacon and her parents boarded a steamship bound for China. Coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine, Ursula Bacon talks with Celeste Quinn about what it was like to come of age when the world was at war. She's the author of a new book titled Shanghai Diary, A Young Girl's Journey from Hitler's Hate to War-Torn China. She'll be talking with Celeste Quinn. That'll be in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. The program itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580 with the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other features. In the next hour of this show, we'll have another program looking at the Middle East, talking particularly about what's happening with the Palestinians now that Yasser Arafat has passed. Our guest will be Fawaz Jerjez. He's Christian Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. He'll be joining us by phone in the next hour. First, though, we'll break for news and update on the market, so please stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health.